So we're going to switch gears for a little bit and talk about Uzbekistan. We'll give you a break from Chinese policy. My co-authors on this are Darren Hudson, Ryan Williams, Philip Johnson, and Catherine Hayhoe from Texas Tech University. The FAO defines food security as when all people at all times have access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food to maintain a healthy life. This definition of food security is built on three pillars: food availability, food access, and food use. This presentation is going to be focusing on the first of these pillars, which is food availability. There are 850 million people that are food insecure in the world today. By 2022, that number will increase by 37 million, and world population will increase to 8 billion. Much of this growth is projected to occur in developing countries where household survival often depends on local crop production, and 40% of this increase in population may also be living in a stressed watershed. The idea for this project came about from my interest in population growth and how that affects anthropogenic climate change and how that impacts water scarcity, agricultural production, and then secondary impacts on human migration and civil conflict. And the area of Central Asia really fit the bill for everything that we were kind of looking for to do in this analysis. So this is a map of Central Asia. It's comprised of five countries. We have Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. Water resources are extremely important to agriculture in this region, and they originate from the mountainous areas of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. The Syr-Darya River originates here and flows into the northern part of the Aral Sea, and the Amu-Darya River originates in Tajikistan and flows into the southern part of the Aral Sea. I've chosen an important but small agricultural region located in Uzbekistan along the Amu-Darya River here to perform the case study analysis for this paper. The collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 left the Central Asian countries with no institutional structure and no incentive for efficiency. They collectivized agriculture, moving toward dominant cotton monoculture production. Historically, this area has been known for its abundance in water resources. However, the Soviets exploited their vast water reserves, which eventually led to the desiccation of the Aral Sea. They also have not maintained their irrigation systems over time, so they're heavily deteriorated, and only 50% of water released from the reservoirs actually reach the crop. Uzbekistan in particular is a relatively labor-abundant country, so they must rely on irrigated agriculture to establish food security. 90% of water resources in Central Asia are used for agriculture, and Uzbekistan alone receives 60% of that allotment. Tajikistan is currently building a hydroelectric power plant that's located along the Amu-Darya River, which could significantly reduce the amount of river inflows to Uzbekistan for irrigation. So we might see some conflict or some tension erupting in the future over these water rights. Uzbekistan produces a variety of crops like cotton, rice, wheat, fruit, vegetables, and livestock. And I think this year they will be the sixth largest exporter of cotton in the world. Their government still maintains cotton production quotas. So for the producers there, they must dedicate 40% of their acreage to cotton production every year. The objective of this paper was to determine the amount of food and fiber availability in the Khorezm region of Uzbekistan as a result of changing climate conditions over time. And this objective was accomplished in four tasks. The first was to examine the uncertainty on deterministic point estimates from downscale climate projections using a Monte Carlo simulation. The second was to evaluate the relationship between crop yields and water for each crop produced, and that was using DSAT, a crop growth model. And the third was to look at optimal cropping choices to maximize producer profits in the face of their dwindling water resources. And we did that by looking at by using a nonlinear optimization model. And the fourth was to look at the impacts of policy-induced market distortions given these climate change impacts. This is just a flow chart of my methods and procedures. Global climate models were downscaled to specific weather stations located in Uzbekistan, and those are included in crop growth models. The crop growth model will output yield estimates, and so I created crop production functions from those yield estimates, which were included in a nonlinear optimization model, and then from there, derived sensitivity and policy analyses. For my downscale climate projections, I had 9 global climate models that were downscaled to 73 weather stations. I ended up only using 4 for temperature and 6 for precipitation because those were located in that Khwarezm study region. My climate variables that I had were minimum and maximum temperatures and precipitation. I had 2 relative concentration pathway scenarios, or CO2 scenarios. So later on, whenever you see a 4.5, that's referring to a low CO2 scenario. And whenever you see an 8.5, that's referring to a higher CO2 scenario. I had 3 time periods, the near term from 2012 to 2039, mid-century projections from 2040 to 2069, and century projections from 2070 to 2099. The downscaled climate projections were simulated using Monte Carlo, and I created a time path that used the mean from the previous day plus or minus the effect of a random shock. And this model was iterated 100 times. This random shock here was derived by using a normal distribution from the means and variances of the residuals of a random walk without drift. And I also included a sine wave in the model to account for seasonality in the daily projections and a time trend as well. So this is a figure of average global climate model outputs for maximum temperature with a low CO2 scenario. You can notice the increasing trend over time, and temperature increases from 19 to 22 degrees Celsius over from 2012 to 2100. And this is what the global climate models look like overlaid with my climate simulation. So you can see that I've been able to match the time trend of the climate simulation, or the global climate model outputs. But we have an increase, it kind of fans out over time. And we performed a GARCH 1-1 model on these downscale climate projections and found no evidence of conditional heteroscedasticity. So what I did was to include that in the model. It creates this fanned out look, which makes it more realistic because we don't know what the temperature is going to be by 2100, and their projections show with a certain amount of certainty that they know what will happen. And so we just tried to make it look more realistic. For my production functions, I created 4 for cotton, rice, wheat, and tomatoes. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about rice and tomatoes, but I used 30 of the climate simulations that I did for my Monte Carlo simulations as an input into the DSAP model, and I calibrated it with region-specific type parameters such as soil type, crop management techniques, and irrigation levels. Once I had yield outputs from DSAT, I created quadratic production functions with yield as a function of water applied and water applied squared. You'll notice the intercept term is missing, and that is because there is no dryland crop production in this area, so it was removed. The nonlinear optimization model, with this I did not have a way to determine what the climate change projections were going to have on melting snowpack from the mountainous regions and river inflows into Uzbekistan. So what I did was to simply simulate reservoir outflows using a beta distribution. And I added constraints into this model to restrict some rice acreage. And I included that cotton production quota. So that 40% that they must maintain in their acreage every year is included. And that is part of the baseline scenario that we run. And then I also looked at what would happen if that cotton quota was removed. So these are results for the baseline model. And in the near term, for a high CO2 scenario, crops actually perform worse for cotton, rice, and vegetables than in the low CO2 scenario. So when we have that 4.5, it's the low, and the 8.5 is the high CO2. As CO2 begins to build in the atmosphere over time, crops begin to respond positively to this increase in CO2, with cotton, rice, and wheat yields increasing in the midterm with the high CO2 scenario. And then in the far term, temperatures have reached their maximum, so the effect of CO2 kind of offsets that increase in temperature, so it kind of depends on the crop as to how well they perform in the century projections. But if you look at wheat yields are higher in the near and midterm high CO2 scenario, and they perform better in the far century with a low CO2 scenario, so keep that in mind. These are results for average net returns for a given producer in Uzbekistan, and they're higher for a near low CO2 or near high high CO2 and mid-high CO2, and then in the far term, they're higher here. So these net returns follow wheat yields. So basically what this means is that the relative value of wheat is higher than the value of cotton. Wheat is simply more profitable, and that's why they're getting net returns. This is a figure of crop acreage percentages for the near term from 2012 to 2039. You can see cotton production decreases from 60% to 40% by 2034, and wheat is increasing over time to kind of meet that. In the midterm, in this baseline scenario, we see cotton production stays at that 40% level as mandated by their government, and the wheat increases to about 45% by 2069. In the century term, wheat is about 50%. We have 40% cotton and 10% rice. So when we remove that cotton quota, the yields don't change at all. It's the same scenario as before. You can see the average net returns and the percent change from the baseline. So if anything, producers benefit a little bit from that removal of that policy removal. So it's not going to hurt them at all if the government does remove that. This is crop acreage percentages for this policy removal, and you can see that cotton decreases past that 40% to about 35% by the end of the near term, and wheat increases to almost 75% by the mid-century, and cotton is decreasing to about 10%. In the century projections, they're producing almost all wheat at 85% and almost no cotton. So what we've determined from this is that climate change really has a minimal impact on what's going on in the region. It's mainly due to distortions from their agricultural markets that has the biggest influence in what's happening there. It does not appear that Uzbekistan has a comparative advantage in cotton production. If they do switch from cotton to wheat, it looks like they will establish some food availability, some food security if they do that. However, they've generated a lot of revenues from their fiber receipts. So if they do stop producing cotton, they may lose their access to international markets. But there's a lot of things going on in the region, and that's all I have for you today. So if you have any questions. Yes. They do. The farmers the government gives the farmers one price, and the government will turn around and sell it in the world market for a higher price. No, I did not. Prices were constant over time, so I used, because this is from a producer standpoint, I used state prices in Uzbekistan, but you're right. I mean, that would have a big impact, but this model didn't really take that into account.